A 2,500-year-old sarcophagus with vivid color illustrations from Homer's epics has been discovered in western Cyprus. The construction workers found the limestone sarcophagus last week in a tomb. The tomb, which probably belonged to an ancient warrior, had been looted during antiquity. Reflecting a long oral tradition loosely based on historic events, Homer's epics were probably composed around 800 B.C., and written down in the 6th century B.C. Amazing story. A couple other amazing stories as well with our special guest upcoming, Robert Temple, The Serious Mystery, in his latest work, Oracles of the Dead, Ancient Techniques for Predicting the Future. We'll talk with Robert about both of these in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Robert Temple is visiting professor of the history and philosophy of science at Tsinghua University in Beijing, fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, member of the Egypt Exploration Society, Royal Historical Society, Institute of Classical Studies and the Society for the Promotion of Hellenic Studies, and visiting research fellow of the University of the Aegean in Greece. He is the author of 10 books. That includes Oracles of the Dead. This book examines ancient methods of foretelling the future and discovering the physical location of the Greek underworld. We know this as Hades, and explores the mysteries associated with the Delphi and other oracles of the ancient world. Drawing evidence from a range of sources within orthodox scholarship, physics, and biology, Robert shows how the latest developments in science may validate the system of the I Ching. This book also includes a theory of change based upon recent scientific work in a variety of fields. In addition, he wrote, produced, and presented the documentary film Descent into Hell, based upon this book, for the National Geographic Channel. And also he has written, I believe, one of the critically acclaimed books called The Serious Mystery. Absolutely stunning story. We'll talk with him about that first this hour, then next hour get into the Oracles of the Dead, then the third hour we'll open up the phone lines for you. Our special guest tonight, Robert Temple. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Okay, nice to talk to you, George, even though we're separated by the Atlantic.
Thousands of miles on this one, aren't we?
Well, that's nothing compared to the light years with which we are separated from our friends in space.
Robert, I have been wanting to talk with you about the Serious Mystery, and then having seen your works, The Oracles of the Dead, this is just going to be a two-for-one night for me personally, so I'm glad we've got you on the program. Tell me a little bit more about you beyond just what I read.
Well, I'm originally American, but I've lived in England most of my life. I grew up in Kentucky, so I'm a sort of hick, you could say. In which I take great pride, because I think hicks are very good, being one, I'd have to think that. And I had a very nice time growing up surrounded by such a beautiful place as the state of Kentucky. So that's my plug for Kentucky.
The bluegrass land, huh?
Yes, it's not blue, but it's beautiful.
Now, you are where right now as we speak to you?
I'm sitting in London, which is a place where I spend a great deal of time because I live in England.
The Serious Mystery, a tremendous story of the tribe in West Africa. How did you come upon that story to the point where you did so much research? And I've got to tell everybody, when you get a chance to read the works of Robert Temple, he not only writes it from the perspective of a researcher and author, but he actually visits and lives part of the stories that you see. And I'll talk about that when we talk about oracles, because he went on some trips that I would never go on because they would scare me to death. But how did you come across and am I pronouncing this tribe right, the Dogon tribe? Do they pronounce it like that?
Dogon.
Dogon, okay. Tell me about this story and how you became familiar with it.
Well, it was all an accident, but due to the fact that I don't like loose ends, and if something doesn't quite fit, I never give up trying to figure out what might be wrong. Somebody said something to me that was a bit off one day, and I said, hold on, that can't be true. And I began to look into it, and it resulted in that book. In fact, what happened was I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, where I went when I was 16 years old, and I knew a very brilliant man called Arthur Young through one of my best pals at university called John Cogshaw, and I used to call in on Arthur, who had a house in Philadelphia, and he was at a phase of his life then when he was sitting around reading every book he could find about African tribal mythologies. And I used to tease him a bit about that. And so one day he said, you know, I've been reading a really interesting one this time. It's a tribe who live in a country called Mali in West Africa, and they're called the Dogon. Well, in fact, he said the Dogon tribe. He made a joke about it. And I later discovered they were called the Dogon. And he said, you know, their religion and their culture are quite different from most of the African tribes. It's based upon the star Sirius. The star Sirius, I said, come on. What do you mean their religion and their culture are based on the star Sirius? A tribe in Africa, what do they know about the star Sirius? They haven't got any telescopes there, have they? Well, of course, Sirius is a very bright star, so you don't need a telescope to see that. But he said, well, no, the strange thing is that it's not really the star Sirius that they're on about, but what they say is some sort of companion star to Sirius, which goes around it. And I knew enough astronomy to realize that there was such a thing. The astronomers call it Sirius B. In other words, the main bright star that you can see in the sky being the biggest and the brightest, they call Sirius A because it's the first.
Right.
And then the little one that you can't see, they call it Sirius B. So I said, well, Arthur, there is a Sirius B, you know, and it is small and you can't see it as far as I know. I'll have to go check. But how could a tribe in Africa have their whole religion and culture based on anything as weird as that? Oh, well, I don't know, he said, and then he moved on to the next tribe. Well, I wasn't satisfied, and I started looking into this, not immediately, but a bit later on, and discovered that this was not only true, but the tribe admitted that they had never actually seen this little star, because you can't see it without at least a 15-inch telescope, and of course they didn't have them. And they knew its exact orbital period. Well, they admitted that they knew the orbital period of something they couldn't see.
Amazing.
It was 9 light years away. So what's going on here? And this is how the whole thing began.
Is the tribe still in existence, Robert?
Very much so, although they're under a great deal of pressure from two sources. One, the government of Mali is run by very earnest Muslims, and they want the Dogon to convert to Islam. Of course, everybody's supposed to convert to Islam, so you better get ready, George. But the Dogon are being pressured to give up all these traditional beliefs, which make the Muslims who run the country very nervous, because, well, everything makes Muslims nervous that isn't in the Quran or the Hadith. So the Dogon can't really get jobs or anything like that unless they first convert and thereby give up these amazing traditions, which are the basis of my book. So, of course, that makes me very unhappy. But the other thing that's putting them under even more intense pressure is the terrible drought in the Sahel region of Africa.
Oh, yeah, my God, yes.
And there's just such a shortage of water. And since the Dogon live by growing onions, even though onions don't take a great deal of water and are quite happy in fairly dry conditions, if you haven't got any water, you haven't got any onions, and therefore you haven't got a life.
How many members of the tribe are out there, Robert? Approximately.
I'm afraid I can't tell you that. That's a very interesting question, George, and you're the first person who's ever asked me that, and which goes to show how sharp you are. But it's not only the Dogon themselves that are involved in this, because there are related tribes, so you don't know quite where to draw the line. There's a tribe called the Bozo and a tribe called the Bambara, and they all also share these serious traditions.
Okay, now, this belief system in the Sirius tradition would scan approximately how many years? Hundreds of years? Thousands of years?
Well, the Dogon and all those other tribes that I mentioned, including the extraordinary tribe called the Akan in Ghana, they are all descended from migrants who came down across the Sahara Desert from the North African regions and who intermarried with the local black population, so that now all these tribes are totally black in appearance and have a mixture of languages. That is, they speak languages which are from black Africa, but they have sort of sub-languages and secret languages which are of other origins. It's all very complex, and the Dogon have a system of written signs, of which they have about 30,000 sort of hieroglyphic type things. It's a very, very, very complex story. But we know that the ancestors of all these people migrated south about 700 or 800 years ago, maybe 1,000, and reached this part of West Africa.
Okay.
And spread out through Mali and Ghana. They came from the northeast, and we know the migration route. And in the Serious Mystery, I give the map of the migration. And all of this is reconstructed on the basis of anthropological studies and historians and real evidence. None of this is just speculation. It's all things that are known.
Now, when we get into the Oracles of the Dead next hour, I know for a fact that you have been in these tunnels in that book that we're going to talk about. So you have a definite hands-on relationship to your work. In this particular one, The Serious Mystery, did you end up having to go there, out there in West Africa, to visit these people?
Well, no. I went to Paris to see the French anthropologists who had studied them, of course, and discussed it with them. But by the time I was involved in all of this, the elderly informants in the Dogon tribe who had given the information to the French anthropologists, which they published back in the 1950s, they were all dead. I wouldn't have got very far, and the only way I could have talked to those people would have been in their own language, which I didn't know, even if they had been alive. So I relied basically on the information gathered by these French anthropologists and published in obscure anthropological journals in the 1950s, which nobody had ever noticed because I had to go dig them out. And these were all published in French, not in English. And although some of that material has now been translated into English, at the time I was working on all of this, most of it was unavailable in English. And it was quite a struggle to make head or tail of this. But these were just ordinary, everyday anthropologists who were publishing this material in the way that anthropologists do in their anthropological journals, and nobody but other anthropologists ever read it, and most of them didn't read it because anthropologists don't really read each other's articles because they all work on different tribes. And so this material was completely buried and forgotten, and I had to dig it all out, and that really wasn't easy.
Are there a number of anthropologists who believe that perhaps something extraterrestrial has happened here with this tribe, or is it just a handful of people, or maybe just you?
Well, anthropologists are very, very intensely academic people, and even though that they live with a lot of tribes in obscure localities and may have a subsistence diet and behave just like the tribe's people they're studying, so that they're flexible in their living habits. But in their scholarly habits, they're very, very rigid people by and large. And so you won't find very many anthropologists who are even willing to mention the word extraterrestrial. And the reason for this is they're terribly afraid all the time of criticism by their colleagues.
Sure.
if you're in the academic world living on a campus and you want to get your promotion from assistant lecturer to full lecturer, if you want to become an assistant professor and then you want to become an associate professor and then you want to become a full professor and then you want to become a dean or a provost or something like that, you have to play the game. And if you're going to start going around talking about spacemen, you're out.
Oh, but what a theory, because this is of everything that I have studied and looked at in this entire field of, the possibility of extraterrestrial life. It's your story. It's this story about the Sirius mystery that, to me, is the most exciting of all of them, beyond Roswell and what may have happened in 1947. The fact that this tribe in Africa has witnessed something that, as you said, you cannot see with the naked eye. And I am sure even 500 years ago or 1,000, this planet wasn't in a situation where you could still see that with the naked eye. It's impossible. Something else must have happened. They got information in some other way. Had to have.
That's why the book is called The Sirius Mystery, because it is a mystery. And the I should draw the distinction between planets and stars here. The Dogon tribe know very well the difference between planets and stars, which is more than a lot of people in the street or in the mall might do, by the way.
Well, even that's amazing, isn't it? All that by itself, the fact that they would even be able to distinguish the difference or know the difference, that's pretty good.
I know. As I say, there's a lot of people walking along the street today who don't know that much. And the Dogon are very, very particular in their descriptions. They admit that they believe that beings came from the system of the star Sirius to the Earth in the distant past. That's their story, and they're sticking to it. And these are the heroic figures who founded civilization on the Earth. But they did not land in Africa. People who glance at my book often think, oh, God, Robert Temple's talking about spacemen in Africa. What next? But it's not that at all. The beings that they claim landed in the place from which their ancestors came. They didn't land in Mali. So that's very important. Now, the information says that they came from a planet that orbited a star. They didn't live on a star. That's not possible. You'd get burned up in a split second, wouldn't you? So the system of the star Sirius, according to the Dogon, consists of three stars. There's the little one I mentioned, Sirius B, and then they said there was this third one, which according to their descriptions would be a red dwarf, as the astronomers call them. And so I made the prediction back in the 1970s when the original edition of The Sirius Mystery was published, which was 1976. I said that astronomers one day, in my opinion, will confirm the information given by the Dogon tribe that there is a third star in that system which will be discovered to be a red dwarf. And in 1995, it was confirmed in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics by two French astronomers, radio astronomers, called Benet and Duvant. They published an article in 1995 after spending many years studying the perturbations of the stars in the Sirius system, which means a little bit of jiggling due to gravitational effects.
They discovered this
third star, and they said that, and they described it. And of course, from their description, we're talking about a red dwarf. So, my prediction, 20 years later, was verified. And when that happened, I decided to reissue the Sirius Mystery in a revised edition, which came out in 1998, which contains 50% more material. And you can buy this book from Inner Traditions, my American publisher. Yay! Inner Traditions! Inner Traditions, everybody!
And they also
published the other book that you mentioned.
Robert, we'll be back. We'll be back in a moment. Just hold on. We'll be right back with our special guest tonight, Robert Temple. We're going to continue talking about the Sirius Mystery because it is an incredible story. I'm George Norrie. Oh, by the way, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it's robert-temple.com. We'll be right back. Robert Temple, our guest. Robert, the ancestors of the Dogon tribe, where did they come from then?
Well, the Dogon say they came from up north, and we know that they came across the Sahara. And so I set about a very lengthy research process to find out who the hell were these ancestors and where did they come from, just as you've asked. And I managed to trace most of the bits and pieces and details of the Dogon information to ancient Egypt, but in fragmentary form. In other words, the Dogon gave the anthropologists a very coherent and consistent account of all the details of what they were talking about, including the orbital period and all of that. And I found most of this information, a little bit here, a little bit there, in fragmentary form, was in existence in ancient Egypt. And so what seems to have happened is this, that at some time, a group of religious zealots were driven out of Egypt, whose chief god was Amun, and they made their way, first of all, to the oasis of Siwa, which is on the Egyptian-Libyan border. And then they were driven into Libya, where they became known at the time of the ancient Greek historian Herodotus as the Garamantes tribe. And they were driving around in chariots and were quite fierce warriors. And then they were driven further and further west and further south. And they went from oasis to oasis and finally migrated down into Africa and intermingled with the locals. But they kept these traditions. Now, the god of the Dogon tribe is called Amma, A-M-M-A, Amma, which is basically the same as Amun or Amun.
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
And that's the name of their god today. And so they seem to have been a group who were religious purists of a priestly nature, who believed that only by leaving Egypt at some moment of crisis, which can't have been later than the New Kingdom, and may well have been earlier, we don't know, that they thought that they could only preserve the true secrets of Sirius by emigrating in order to preserve it intact without contamination by some religious change. This could have happened during the reign of Akhenaten. We don't know. We'll never know. But this seems to have been the motivation. And in ancient Egypt, the star Sirius was of fundamental importance and was identified with the goddess whose name was Isis. And the rising of Sirius, which is an astronomical phenomenon, was New Year's Day for the Egyptians. Their calendar, their sacred calendar, was based entirely upon the star Sirius, not on the sun and the moon. Of course, they had solar and lunar calendars as well, as the Dogon do. The Dogon even have a Venus calendar. They've got four calendars. And all of this information seems to have been brought from ancient Egypt. So if you're wondering where did the extraterrestrials land, there's your answer.
Well, it makes you wonder then about the true significance of the pyramids, for example, if things occurred in that area a long, long time ago.
That's true, and this gets us into many other issues, but I'm not the shy type, so I have attempted to tackle this. But as you notice, George, I'm so bashful, I can barely bring myself to speak to you.
I like you, Mr. Temple.
I like you too, George, even though we're on opposite sides of the ocean. But people will talk if we go on like this.
Well, let me tell you, though, I could talk to you for hours. As long as this program is, believe it or not, 3 hours with you, this is something that we could talk about for the next 50 years. It is just fascinating. Did the tribe ever leave behind any, when you're talking about hieroglyphics, did they leave behind any symbols or drawings of what they said or believed these extraterrestrials to be or their craft?
Yes, many. A lot of this is reproduced in my book. First of all, they do very detailed sand drawings of the orbital situation of the Sirius system, you know, showing the planets and the stars and all the orbits, by the way, are elliptical, not circular, so they've got that right. And they also do pictures of the beings who they say were aquatic. And they give very, very precise physical descriptions of them. They were air-breathing, but aquatic. So they were a bit like dolphins or whales, but they were a bit larger than humans, but not that much larger. And they had fish tails, but they weren't fish, because, you know, fish don't breathe air. They've got gills. So these are more like dolphin creatures.
Now, how did they get here?
Well, the Dogon describe this in the most intriguing way. First of all, they describe their landing vehicles, which are descriptions precisely like landing vehicles that we would have to land on the moon or Mars today. That is, with the roaring sound and the raising the dust and the fire coming out of the bottom, which goes out after it lands, and all of that, which would be your standard everyday landing craft, which I suppose even very futuristic space explorers would still use to come down and land on a planet with an atmosphere, a normal rocket sort of arrangement. But they say that when these beings, who they call the Nomo, first appeared, there was a new star appeared in the sky. And they appeared to describe a geosynchronous orbit because it remained in place. They call it the star of the 10th moon. And then when the Nomo left, that star disappeared. So this appears to be a mothership in geosynchronous orbit during the course of the visitation that they are describing. And then from that, they would have disembarked in these landing craft, and they describe and do drawings of the landing craft and show all the fire and smoke and everything.
All right. Now, if they look dolphin-like, did they have arms, and how do they move around?
Well, the arms are described as being without elbows. So, in other words, they are more flexible than our arms, and they breathe through breathing holes in the area of what we call the breastbone or the clavicles. And it's amazing how precise the descriptions are, really. And they're described also as being a bit repulsive. And so I found many ancient traditions of the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Chinese, all claiming that civilization was established on Earth by disgusting, slimy, aquatic beings with snaky or fishy tails. And all of this is presented in the Sirius Mystery at a very great length. And in the revised edition of 1998, I added all the Chinese and Greek material, which I hadn't included in the original edition, where I concentrated on the Babylonian and Sumerian traditions. But when you look around at the very earliest accounts all over the ancient world, really you find the same thing everywhere, that civilization was established by these weird aquatic fishy beings. In China, they're known as Fushi and Nugua. In ancient Greece, Athens was founded by a being called Kekrops, who was one of these creatures. And according to the Sumerians and Babylonians, a being known by the Greek translation of his name as Oannes, founded civilization. And the Babylonian and Assyrian temples were full of gigantic statues of these beings with all the fish tails, and they were the culture heroes who created civilization on Earth. And this is the almost unanimous testimony of ancient times, but it's all been largely ignored, or at least until I started calling attention to it, and how this agrees with the very specific account of this amazing African tribe, the Dogon. So we've got a real story here, George.
Oh, it's a great story. It is, Haps. I'm in awe over this. Why didn't they make us in their image? If they were going to come down here and genetically play around with whatever beings might have been on the planet at the time, how come we don't look like they do?
Well, I don't make any claim for them genetically playing around with us.
Okay.
I present my whole thing as a hypothesis based on the information I've discovered. I don't insist that it's true, although I personally think that it is, but I don't insist upon that.
It sounds like something happened. I don't know exactly what it is, and your theory is as good as any other, and there aren't any other out there. But it something happened with this tribe. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Well, there are many strange and wholly bizarre aspects of this, which are even stranger than what we've discussed. And over the 30 years since I originally published this book, it's actually 30 years ago that the first version of it appeared, and I spent 9 years writing it. I've spent most of my life heavily preoccupied every day thinking about what this all means. And the more I think about it, and all these years later, I've got to say this, the stranger it gets, because there are so many disturbing aspects of it that aren't immediately apparent. You see, the story is so bizarre that it's easy to get carried away by your first impression of it and your second impression and your third impression. But when you've been thinking about it for 39 years, as I have, well, then you get your 100 millionth impression, and the further you go on thinking about it, the implications become just really so bizarre that it would take another book to describe those, and I haven't written it.
Why do you think they left?
Well, that's part of what I'm referring to. Why did they leave? And or did they?
Or did they?
When, if you think about the logistics of physical space travel, you're heavily restricted. And assuming you're capable of it in the first place.
At least the way we think of propulsion.
Well, pardon?
At least the way we think of propulsion right now.
Yes. If you're talking about physical space travel, that is transporting your actual physical body over interstellar distances, you're probably limited to one-way journeys. And the only way it would be possible is you would have to go into suspended animation, like you call it the deep freeze.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you'd wake up when you got there, you'd be revived,
or stumble into a portal. Maybe there's some kind of tunnel that they throughout the universe that they can transport time and space. Maybe they found something like that.
Well, yes. In fact, in the new edition of The Serious Mystery, I give all the evidence which leads me to believe that the solar system of our Earth and our Sun and the system of Sirius, which is 8.7 light years away, are part of a greater system which I call the Anubis Cell, named in honor of the Egyptian dog-headed god, which is all part of my account of the Egyptian mythology,
mm-hmm.
and Sirius being the dog star. And so I point out that the systems are linked by various means to do with numerical astrophysical quantities and natural constants in such a way that I think that we should look upon our sun's system and the Sirius system as being astronomically linked as a subunit of the galaxy, and therefore travel between them would be easier than it would normally be between just any old star and any old other star. After all, we are very near neighbors. But I still think that the physical transportation of physical bodies would probably have to go through this suspended animation phase. And so when you asked about why did they leave, and I said, well, maybe they didn't. What I really meant by that was that they probably retreated to the outer edge of our own solar system, parked their vehicle there, and went back into hibernation. Because I'm talking about a visitation that was thousands of years ago, and therefore they would never have gone home. That's the point. The Dogon imply this when they say that they will return, and when they do, it will be called the Day of the Fish, and they will rule from the waters, as they put it. So that has political implications and is what the spooks would call the ultimate security issue.
Absolutely. And we are talking about rising sea levels now, too, aren't we?
Room for more of them.
Exactly. Is it possible that the dolphins of today that are on this planet might be descendants of these beings in some form or fashion?
I wouldn't say descendants, but I would think that the dolphins would be like the pets of these guys.
That's interesting.
You know, like we have dogs, because I'm a great dog lover. You know, I think dogs are nicer than people. And so if you were an Amo, you'd be just as fond of your pet dolphin as I was of my dog before she died.
And you were saying that this story basically is throughout China and other regions of this planet as well.
Yes, and I publish all the pictures. And I've spent many years going to China, and I've written a book called The Genius of China, which is actually part of the Chinese secondary school curriculum, and I'm a visiting professor over there and all that. And so I'm fairly up on my Chinese things, and I've put all of that evidence in there. It's very important to realize that the Chinese, although they were pretty much isolated from the Western traditions, also maintained that civilization was founded by aquatic beings. And they draw pictures of them, and I reproduce these.
That is fascinating. And I would assume the stories somehow echo the Dogon tribe?
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, that's something. That is amazing. It's an incredible story, and I've been wanting to talk with you about that for the last 100 years, I think. And I'm glad we got you on that. Next hour, Robert, we're going to devote our time to the Oracles of the Dead, an equally stunning story. But in this case, you're there going through some of these tunnels, which you'll explain next hour, what you believe they might be, and how I think modern-day religions have somehow taken what might have been in Greek mythology or Greek episodes and have kind of turned it into something very interesting about Hades and hell. I found that correlation pretty fascinating myself. The work into Oracles of the Dead, how long did it take you to do this one?
Well, in a way, Oracles of the Dead is a very direct outgrowth of the Sirius Mystery, which had a lot in it about oracles, but I decided to go much deeper into it. And when I did, I discovered really, really strange things. Everything I do seems to be strange, George, including talking to you, by the way.
You don't do a lot of these lengthy interviews, do you?
Well, if I were asked.
Well, I got to tell you, though, there's pictures of you going down some of those tunnels, and you could not pay me to do that.
Well, if you have claustrophobia, you'd have a problem. I was crawling through tunnels which are only 18 inches high, you know, for hundreds of feet, and it's a bit challenging, but you have to, take a deep breath. Well, in fact, it's difficult to take a deep breath because there's no oxygen down there. That's the other thing. You sort of are in danger of passing out. It's actually pretty dangerous.
I could not do that. Stay with us, Robert. We'll be back with you in just a moment. As I mentioned, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's robert-temple.com. And when we come right back, we're going to talk about his latest work, fascinating, equally fascinating, called Oracles of the Dead. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, by the way, you've got an open invitation to come back to Coast anytime you want.
Gosh,
anytime.
George. Well, that's great.
And, you know, pulling a phrase from United States baseball, of course you're from Kentucky, so you'll remember this. You've hit another home run with this one, Oracles of the Dead. I love this book, too.
Well, thanks, George. I'm glad you do, because it's got some stuff that's pretty important in it, would you say?
Sure does. You know, we do a lot of predicting on this show, Robert. We get psychics who come in and other people, and we kick things around. And you know what? Some of them come true. Some of them don't. But let's go way back as you examine the Greek and Roman traditions and some of these techniques. Very different from what a lot of people are using today. Tell us a little bit about Oracles of the Dead. What does that mean?
Well, the book is about oracles and divination worldwide. So the first half of the book is about the ancient Western traditions, mostly Greek and Roman, but also Babylonian. And then the second half is entirely about China, because as you know, China's becoming more and more important in the world and regaining its position that it lost through civil war and revolution and all that that went on that suppressed it artificially for so long. And if we're talking about the world, we need to talk about the East and the West both. And so I decided in this book that I was going to have half and half. And I think that I made great strides in both directions. And it's being translated into Chinese as we speak. In fact, I've got another book called The Crystal Sun, which is coming out in China in about 2 weeks' time. And the translation of Oracles of the Dead is almost complete, and it will come out in a few months. And I've been asked to give special seminars in Beijing, not only for academics, but also for government officials, believe it or not. They take the Book of Change, the I Ching, which many people call the I Ching, very seriously indeed. And because I made some breakthroughs on figuring out how it works, they want to explore this a lot more. But to go back to the things that you were more interested in, the underground oracle of the dead, that's the really scary part of the book. And that's what it starts with. And that is the most fantastic place that very few people alive have ever been into, because, of course, it's not open to the public at all. And my wife and I were really the first people living along with our friend Michael Bagent, you know, the author of The Holy Blood and Holy Grail.
Well, he's been in the news lately, hasn't he?
Yeah, Michael's a great pal of mine, and I was at the final day of the trial yesterday, as a matter of fact. But I won't discuss the trial, but I saw Michael, of course, and his wife and daughter. And he came with us on this trip. I asked him along, and he was able to take some of the photos of me, and I was able to take some photos of him, and we had a great time. But as you pointed out earlier on, it's not the kind of place you would go on holiday, because we're crawling through 18-inch high tunnels, choking on dust with breathing masks and all of that, and running out of air, and it's pretty spooky, although I'm not easily intimidated, nor is my wife Olivia, because we got so familiar with the place that when we went back later and filmed it for the documentary that we made, which was for the National Geographic Channel.
Yeah.
Olivia went down all on her own, and you see, there are, well, I better describe it a bit before you can appreciate what it was.
Yeah, and the location for everybody.
Yeah. This is an underground site cut out of the solid rock, which is a quarter of a mile long in its various tunnels and chambers. And it was a replica of hell made by the ancient Greeks, and it was done on the west coast of southern Italy, which used to be Greek Italy. This is long before the Romans existed,
mm-hmm.
when the Greeks had colonized that whole area. It's near an ancient city called Cuma, which is said to be the earliest Greek settlement in Italy. And it's at a place called Baia, which takes its name from one of the friends of Odysseus, or Ulysses. And it was known in antiquity as the Oracle of the Dead. What it was a kind of, well, I hate to say this, but it was like a Disneyland version of hell. That is, it was an artificial hell, just so that you can understand, that was constructed by people. And if you paid a lot of money and went to consult the spirits of the dead at this place in a seance, which they would lay on for you deep underground, they would take you down in there in a drugged state, and you would believe that you were really in the genuine thing. You didn't think that this was like a mock-up or a Disneyland. This was the real thing. You were being taken really into hell. And the effects that they used were so spooky, with all the smoke and lights and sound and barking dogs and all of that, that you really believed it. And they created an artificial river underground known as the River Styx. And you would come to the edge of this river, and you would get on to into a little coracle, which is a small boat, and you would be rowed 150 feet along this underground river past an underground lake called the Lake of Memory, and you would then get out at the far end and go up some steps into a seance chamber where you would consult the dead spirits who would then predict the future for you. And you could see your dead parents and friends and all of that. And this is described in great detail in the Aeneid by Virgil. And it's also described in the Odyssey, because Odysseus himself went down into this place, which is very, very ancient.
Because the construction to do what they did with the kind of technology we assume they had is remarkable.
Well, we don't really know how they did it, because I worked out that it would have taken, I think, a minimum of 50,000 man-hours just to carry the rubble out, because it's carved out of the solid rock, and it's so narrow that you cannot pass anybody in the corridors. Therefore, if you go in and dig your basket full of rock and carry it out again, nobody can come in while you're doing that, so there's a big delay factor while you walk for a quarter of a mile with your basket.
You can't turn when you're in some of these tunnels. You can't turn around, can you? You have to come out like backwards.
Well, in some of them, yes, and you certainly can't pass anybody. It's pretty weird, and it's we've only discovered part of it, because I was able to demonstrate that there's another whole level below. Because I found hollow sounds, and I've done a lot of exploration of it now, and I'm trying to raise the money first to clear it, because it was blocked by the Romans. They filled it up during the reign of Caesar Augustus, the guy who followed Julius Caesar. He had a general and a sort of number one flunky called Agrippa, who married Caesar's daughter, so he became really the power behind the throne, and he got obsessed with this place. He hated it, and he was determined that he was going to make it impossible ever to function again. So he kind of went mad, and he got a large chunk of the Roman army, from what we can gather, to spend all their time carrying soil and rubble back into the place to fill it again.
Ah, okay. And
went on for apparently years, this process of filling up the Oracle of the Dead, which this madman hated so much for reasons we don't know. And so I have to crawl over all this rubble, and I would like to clear it out. And of course, I'm friendly with the local archaeological authorities.
So over the
have to let me in.
Over the hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years, actually, nobody has cleaned this out? It just remains the way it was left?
Well, it was sealed off by a tremendous earthquake in 63 BC during the reign of Nero. And then from that time on, nobody could gain access to the entrance, because everything collapsed on top of it, all the buildings and temples and things, and baths, because the Greeks had temples there, and I was able to find a lot of the stonework of the original temples, which go back to about 550 or 600 BC or whatever. And over them, you could see all the Roman constructions where they turned it into the great baths of Baia. It was like the Biarritz of ancient Rome, and everybody who was anybody went there for the summer. You know, if you weren't seen at Baia, you just weren't in the swing, and the emperor was there with his palace looking down on everybody, and if you were rich and powerful and wanted to get laid, you went to Baia. That was where it was all happening. But in 63 B.C., there was this earthquake that covered it all up. And the whole of Baia was destroyed, because it's very near the volcano of Vesuvius. And so it's also a bit spooky, because you're near all these areas with all the sulfur coming out of the ground and water levels rising and falling and things sinking beneath the sea. And it's a little bit frightening in some ways.
Robert, explain to us the phrase oracles, and exactly the word oracles and what it means and what it meant then.
Well, people today like to read the the astrology columns in the daily papers, but in antiquity, there were no newspapers, and they didn't have astrology columns. So what they had was fortune tellers wandering up and down the streets, and you gave them a little bit of money, and they might tell your fortune, but that wasn't considered really serious. That was for poor people. And if you were a real player, then you would have the real thing, which would be an institutionalized approach towards the prediction. And you would go, if you were a Greek, to various oracle centers, the chief of which was Delphi, which is north of Athens,
right,
on the Mount Parnassus. And you would go there, which was covered in temples, and there was a woman called a Sibyl, who was she was a priestess, and she would go into a trance and deliver her answers to questions that you would submit in writing, and these would be written down by people standing around her who somehow managed not to go into trance, we hope, and then you'd be handed your answer, and people from all over the civilized world, as it was then known by the Greeks, traveled, you know, a lot of them from foreign countries and visiting kings and potentates would all come to Delphi to find out whether they should make war on their neighbors or whether they should divorce their wives or whatever, and ordinary people as well, and you had to pay a fee. So this is quite a big money-making machine, this Delphi enterprise, and they set you up.
The inspiration for them to make their decisions was based on what?
Well, the priestess, the Sibyl, would go into a trance where she was meant to receive her information from the god Apollo, although in the earlier stages of the oracle it wasn't the god Apollo, it was a female goddess, that is the earth goddess Gaia, who was really meant to inspire the original Sibyl, but such were the pressures of male-dominated society in Greece, where women were very much oppressed, as they would be today in somewhere like Saudi Arabia, something like that.
Yeah.
You can imagine that's what ancient Greece was like, that women had to stay indoors, and they certainly couldn't have your job on the radio, if there had been a radio. And so they had to make the god into a male god because this was more fitting for a warrior people and so on. But it's interesting that the Sibyl remained female in this male-dominated society. So even though they changed the sex of her deity from a goddess to a god, they didn't change her sex and try to have a male who was going into trance. They always kept a woman doing it, which is very, very interesting if you're interested in the whole subject, as I am, of the oppression of women and the female influence in religion. I'm greatly in favor of women being priests and rabbis and all of that, very, very much so.
Yeah,
because I think
too.
Women are more in tune with our psychic side than men are. What do you think, George?
I think so, too. As a matter of fact, don't get me started, because I could say some things about why I think that is absolutely should be the case, but that's another issue. I'll have my phone lines burning up instead of people wanting to chat with us about these two great stories.
Let's remember, this is Oracles of Ved published by Inner Traditions.
Absolutely.
And everybody's meant to go out and buy it tomorrow, aren't they, George?
Absolutely. Well, so the people who had the money had the ability to go to these areas, but who in their right mind would want to go to the oracles of the dead, based on what I see in the pictures of you and Michael going through these tunnels? I mean, I'd be scared to death to go. Were they doing this as amusement, or did they think something really was going to happen?
Oh, well, the rubble wasn't there at the time. Of course, it was being used, so you could actually walk standing up. You didn't have to crawl like we do now with lights on our heads and breathing masks. But the situation was, it was very, very, very weird. And I was about to tell you about what Olivia did in it when she went down on her own while
right,
she was filming.
Okay.
Because there were 500 lamp niches cut into the walls of these tunnels where they had oil lamps burning. So Olivia went down on her own into this terrible place and spent 1.5 hours just lighting candles. And we filmed in these tunnels entirely by candlelight. And I can tell you that that was amazing. It was the Cathedral of the Dead. You've got no idea what it's like to walk entirely by candlelight for 800 feet through narrow, spooky tunnels filled with insects and it's just really something else, George. You just have to do it one day.
No, that's okay. I'll trust you. Did you go with remote cameras, or was there a cameraman behind you going through these tunnels as well?
Well, there was a cameraman behind me, and the director, at one point in one of the tunnels, had to drag a mini camera with him on a rope and film himself, because there was no way for the cameraman to get in. And he was so squashed. See, we were on opposite sides of an artificial partition of Roman cement, which was put in there by the Romans that separated two tunnels which had once been connected. And because we didn't have permission to excavate from the archaeological authorities, we couldn't break down this Roman partition. That's what would take place in an excavation, which I hope I will be able to raise the money to fund. And so that the whole place is properly explored and we open up all the concealed portions of this vast complex.
It may go even deeper. It may go farther than you even know.
Oh, we know this. I was able to demonstrate this. And if you go down into the artificial river where the water level has risen because the Romans filled it up with rubble and it's now got a lot of mud at the bottom, but divers have gone down there and gone through to the end, which is 150 feet along, and you come to this huge lake area in the middle, and then it becomes a little river again. And all of this is man-made. None of this is natural. And then you come to the landing stage, and you climb the steps up to the inner sanctum. Well, you can't get into the inner sanctum at the moment because it's been completely filled with rubble and where all the seances took place. And so what I want to do is first clear the whole complex, which is a huge operation just of carrying bags of stuff out, putting them through a sieve in case there's anything interesting in there, and carrying all the soil and rubble away and dumping it somewhere, having extracted from it any bits and pieces. Then once it's cleared, you really want to excavate and get through to the many, many chambers and tunnels which are still blocked, which we haven't.
Let's talk about how this ties into China, Robert, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.
Well, next hour, we're going to open up our phone lines for our guest, Robert Temple, and you. You can talk about the Dogon tribe or also the Oracles of the Dead, ancient techniques for predicting the future. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I got to tell you, Robert, I don't know if it was a game, entertainment for the people of that era, but if I went down in one of those tunnels and thought it was hell, I'd come back and find the ills of my ways very fast.
Well, you know, it was dangerous in another way, which is if you went down there and thought the whole thing was a fake and didn't believe it, that it was really the gods and all and the spirits of the dead, that the whole thing was a put-up job, they killed you.
They killed you?
Yeah, they didn't want any bad propaganda, so this was the ultimate spin, I guess you'd say. If you came out and looked like you doubted the whole thing and thought, I think that was so-and-so wearing a mask or that kind of sound effect was fake, and you thought they thought you might go home and tell everybody that the Oracle of Dead was a load of crap, they'd slit your throat. And then if people said, hey, what happened to him? He went down into the Oracle of the Dead, and the priests would say, he was claimed by the underworld. They wouldn't let him go.
Who ran the Oracle of the Dead? Was this sanctioned by the, let's say, the government of the time?
Well, it was the local industry. It was run by all these priests and their assistants. Think of the Vatican, you know, what the Vatican has done over hundreds of years. They've killed a few people in something called the Inquisition. Well, it was a bit like that.
Yeah, they sure did. Now, how do you tie China, because you've done work with China, you mentioned China in your book, how do you tie that into this?
Well, the Chinese, whom I never like to ignore, in fact I can't because I've spent a large part of the past 20 years going there, And I love China very much, and I've got many Chinese friends. And I've written a whole book just about China called The Genius of China, which is not published by Inner Traditions, but is available on Amazon and whatever. Highly to be recommended. China is somewhere which, if you ignore it, you're doing something bad, very dirty. And so I decided that if I was writing a book about oracles and divination, that it was my duty, and indeed I didn't require a great deal of encouragement because I was looking forward to it, to spend half the book talking about the fantastic divination systems of the Chinese. And most of the listeners to your program will have heard about the Chinese Book of Change, which they mostly would pronounce I Ching, although that's not the way the Chinese pronounce it.
I would pronounce it that way too, yeah.
Yeah, well, the Chinese say I Ching.
I Ching, okay.
I Ching instead of I Ching. I mean, we all know what we're talking about. However we pronounce it, it's the same thing. But the translation means Book of Change or Book of Changes. And it really works. I mean, it's really amazing. But I decided to tackle it in a new way. And so I thought, well, okay, so it works. How does it work? That's what I'm interested in. Because I'm never interested or impressed just to know that something works. I have to know what's happening. And that's what the second half of my book is all about.
Now, the fact that how does it work is an important part of all of this. Ancient techniques for predicting future. Were they accurate, or were they way off?
Well, the Chinese system works for reasons which I give to do with the ultimate structure of matter and to do with its deep understanding of natural processes. The divination and prediction techniques of the ancient Western world, to a large extent, were fabricated, but and when they did function, it was in a non-orderly fashion that would be occasionally as a result of psychic insights or insights gained through trance or hunches or intuition, which they did their best to systematize, but it didn't always work. And so there was quite a lot of trickery that went on. Like the Oracle Centers, of which Delphi was only one, they had a carrier pigeon network, and I've given a long account of the evidence for that and how it was operated, so that if you were hundreds of miles away and somebody won a big battle, you would tie a message to the leg of the carrier pigeon, and he would fly to Delphi, and they'd untie this message, and they'd say, hey, Joe Bloggs just won a battle against John Doe. We better announce it as a prophecy, quick, before the messengers get here. Of course, weeks later, dust-covered, exhausted, thirst-parched messenger would stagger into town and say, oh, God, you don't know it yet, but Joe Bloggs just beat John Doe in a battle on the other side of the world. And everybody would look smug, and they'd say, ha, 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 we've known that for weeks. What are you talking about? Apollo told us.
And that's how they did it.
Well,
trickery. Everything was trickery.
A lot of it was. Some of it was genuine. But you can't have a systematic institution of prediction that's going to be true every day without thinking it. Because
isn't
these things are intermittent and uncontrollable. You can't have a system of prediction that's going to be true this week as well as next week. What happens if your sibyl is ill? What if she's got to have diarrhea or something and she can't do it, you know? Or what if she has a heart attack and dies and you haven't trained your new one up properly to go into trance? You can't shut down the Oracle Center. You've got to keep it going because it's a business, you see. It's like what happened when Woodrow Wilson was president, and he got ill with a stroke. They didn't tell anybody. His wife ran the government, and they kept secret the fact that Woodrow Wilson was incapacitated. They had to keep the White House going somehow. And similarly, they had to keep the Delphic Oracle going.
Well, you're right. And not only for their profit center, but also for the manipulation of people's minds for the time.
Yes, and Delphi was the international bank because everybody put their gold there in the little storehouses because it was considered safe, that because it was protected by the gods and it was sacred and there was a deterrence factor of superstition and religion. It was the only safe place to deposit your money. It was the Swiss banks of the time.
What was or is your take, Robert, on Greek mythology? Do you believe their gods were real and they created these mythological stories about them? Do you believe that they were all myths? Do you believe they might have been extraterrestrial visitors?
Well, I think that some of the mythological figures might refer to extraterrestrial visitors, but they weren't gods, nor did anybody at any time claim that the extraterrestrials were gods. The Dogon are very particular about that, and so were the Babylonians, and so were the Chinese, and so were the Greeks. Everybody's always maintained that they were rather disgusting to look at, I mean disgusting for us as humans to look at. They clearly didn't disgust each other. And that they were slimy because they were aquatic, you know, and a bit creepy and not the sort of guy you'd want your daughter to marry. And indeed, they were, they're not the marrying kind because they were actually a bit like snails, that they were hermaphroditic, you know?
Yes,
they could,
yes.
They could do it to anybody. George, just think about that. Instead of 50% of humanity being your target, 100%.
Yeah.
So, don't want to get too personal there, but the beings who are meant to be extraterrestrial were never described as gods. So the Fontanican type people have got that part completely wrong. But as for the gods, to return to your question, do I think that the Greek gods were real? Having said what I said about these mythological characters like Cecrops. No, but the whole thing about ancient gods looked at from the deeper perspective is you're talking about aspects of the divine. I prefer to talk about the ancient Egyptian religion when it comes down to that question, because everybody knows the Egyptians had all these statues of all these gods with all the animal heads and everything. And they think, hey, that's kind of creepy. But in fact, it was really meant to be deeply symbolic. And a real Egyptian priest at an early period who was into the real thing rather than in the later decadent and debased periods did not pray really to those gods, because they weren't really looked upon as gods. They worshipped instead a principle of cosmic order called Ma'at. And the Egyptian pharaoh was the upholder of Ma'at, which was cosmic order, and was represented by a feather, and also by a form of a goddess. Ma'at was often called a goddess, but nobody believed she was a real goddess. We're talking about a principle. And the gods were all aspects of that principle, because they tried to differentiate it into different categories of what they then called gods and goddesses, and they used all the animal symbols to indicate this. It was all meant to be symbolic. In the ancient Egyptian religion, there was no word that means religion, and there was no word which means belief. The true Egyptian priest did not believe. The true Egyptian priest did not have a religion. This is alien to people today.
Right.
It's a whole different way of looking at things. And a lot of this carried over into the original Greek tradition. And by the time of what's known as the Golden Age of Greece, when you had Plato and Aristotle running around and all that happening in Athens, people were basically laughing at the gods and saying, you know, they're even worse than us. You know, they're full of bad instincts, and they're always beating each other up and raping each other and behaving badly, which sets kind of a bad example for youth. And they weren't taking that seriously, although in public you couldn't really insult them without being accused of impiety and maybe even executed. Don't forget that Socrates was executed in Athens during the so-called Golden Age for what was called impiety, for daring to criticize the gods. Even though nobody really believed in them, they had to preserve the fiction of these gods. And if you challenged the fiction in public, you were challenging the whole structure of society, and you had to go. So they actually murdered Socrates because he scoffed at the gods, even though these were gods nobody really believed in.
Yeah, and I wonder how many other people they did that to.
Yes, well, it was commonly done, and it has been throughout history, and it's still being done today. You know, I could mention certain countries and a certain religion where this happens a lot, but we don't want to get into that one.
It seems to me that we have lost, and let's just look at the Chinese I Ching. Did I say that right?
I Ching.
Not bad. That we have lost overall on this planet the ability to understand this. We have lost the knowledge of it, except in certain areas. How come?
Well, we have to face, I think, the fact that our civilization is collapsing. It's in an advanced state of decadence and decay, and the symptoms of this are all around us. And that's why a lot of the terrorists who hate us are even more dangerous, because their hatred is combined with contempt, and we ourselves have earned that contempt through our decadence and lack of moral values and our lack of belief in deeper things, our worship of money, our sinking into the mire of just being interested in sex, alcohol, and drugs, our obsession with material things and money, our the casual way in which abortion is accepted, abortion, which is the murder of innocent babies for the sake of women wanting to have unprotected sex. They kill the inconvenient human being that results from that. That's murder. We don't even challenge this. We call it the so-called woman's right to choose, but the woman's right to choose is the woman's right to choose to kill. That's what abortion is. And people, really decent, nice people, people that you like, that you might have dinner with, that you might go to a movie with or hold hands with, actually look you in the eye and say they support the murder of babies. And this is no longer shocking. This proves the fantastic level of decadence of our society.
Well, answer this though for me, Robert, because in China, and you have some incredible knowledge of that region, abortion there is common.
Oh, yes, and in China, too. More common than in America. I'm not only talking about Western civilization, I'm talking about world civilization. It is in a state of collapse. People have always been killed heartlessly and mercilessly because we have a streak in humanity which is psychopathic, and it's very dangerous. We're a dangerous species. An extraterrestrial observer might call this the planet of the killer monkeys.
And funny you say that, because I sometimes wish that they would come down and save us from all of this.
Well, as we don't seem to be able to save ourselves from ourselves, maybe somebody should try and help.
True.
Yes, George.
True. Sooner than later, I'm afraid.
I'm sorry if I went into a bit of rant on this subject, but one does get worried about the collapse of civilization and the fact that, combined with climate change, are we still all going to be here in 200 years? I mean,
one of the things we do is we allow our guests to speak the way they think. And that's one of the freedoms and our privilege, I think, and that's what makes this show what it is. So many other places you might not have the ability to say anything. And you know what that's like.
Well, George, programs like yours are really important because of this. You have unusual guests, weirdos like myself, for instance, who say strange things, and that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. That's good. Well, I tell you what, in just a few moments, we're going to open up phone calls, and we're going to see what people want to ask you. Of the books you've done, and let's talk about the two we've talked about tonight, The Serious Mystery, The Oracles of the Dead. Do you favor one over the other?
No, I don't really. I've published 11 books so far, and I've got others which I've written which aren't published yet. And I wouldn't be able to have a favorite. I suppose if you're a father with 12 children, how would you say which one you liked best?
That's true. You cannot. You cannot.
But I can tell you one of my favorite radio interviewers.
Who?
George, try hard to guess.
I'm
would he be you?
I I'm so humble. I wouldn't even say that. Thank you. Appreciate that. I do appreciate that. Well, Zechariah Sitchin, are you ever familiar with his work?
Well, I met Sitchin, and I've read some of his work, but I'm not very familiar with it, no.
Well, he talks about the Sumerians write in their tablets, and depict in their tablets primarily, of an alien civilization coming down here for gold, because they needed to sprinkle the dust in their atmosphere, but that they genetically altered human beings. What I find fascinating about your work, about the Dogon tribe, about Sitchin's work, is that there are a lot of similarities about visitation. And I am now so convinced that something happened on this planet that was so remarkable such a long time ago that you cannot refute it. It's got to be right. It's got to be the fact that we have been visited.
Well, I agree with that. And I think that anybody who closes their mind to the idea is missing the main point, that we're a kind of experiment. And, of course, I have countless ideas about this subject. We are a deeply flawed species, but on the other hand, we do have some aspect to us which, because we're so weird as a species, I believe are unique. And you might wonder why such a deeply flawed species as humans would have been allowed to continue when we've got so many nauseating habits. But I can tell you what I think we do that the others don't do. And you'll be surprised at this. I believe that we have a unique capacity to create music.
Of which we hear now. Stay with us. Robert Temple, our guest. Phone lines, we're going to open them up right now. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Robert Temple, I guess. Robert, some of the ancient observations when you talk about comets, this is a great story if you want to relate it to us about the late Sir Fred Hoyle, one of his thoughts, and how he backed up what the ancients believed.
Well, that's right. Fred was an amazing man, really, really, really brilliant man. And he and a Sri Lankan colleague, Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe, who's a great pal of mine at the University of Cardiff in Wales, jointly, Fred and Chandra, published a couple of books and various articles on the idea that comets were these sort of dirty snowballs, which we now know them to be, full of rubble and rock and whatever, that carried a lot of germs, viruses. And every time they came into the vicinity of the Earth in our solar system, the great tails of spray that they left behind them, which is a comet's tail, would get sort of sprayed over the Earth and gradually percolate down through the atmosphere, and we would catch diseases from these things. And that the mutations of the viruses take place in the comets, so that every time a new comet comes by, you get a new form of flu. It's a bit like the way viruses of flu mutate inside pigs and ducks in China and then spread to the West and kill everybody. They do the same thing in the dirty snowballs known as comets. Now, when they published this, this was considered the utmost, wildest heresy, and everybody behaved in this precious manner about these bad boys in the schoolroom who needed to stand in the corner and be made to behave themselves. And, of course, we now know that it was all very valid, but it took a long time for people to come around to that view. And what Fred and Chandra were doing was taking the ancient idea that comets were often harbingers of disaster, although sometimes of good fortune, and that they preceded plagues. Well, that's true, and it is the most amazing resurrection of an ancient idea by modern scientists.
It's a great theory, too. It is fascinating.
In fact, I was involved with them in the dissemination of this idea as well, because at the time when those books appeared, I was jointly editing a magazine called Second Look, which dealt with the frontiers of science and strange phenomena. My friend Randy Fitzgerald and I, he lives in California, were editing this magazine together, and I approached Fred and Chandra and serialized, and I personally edited the episodes with multiple serial entries of both these books in the magazine, and gave them tremendous prominence and review coverage, and promoted these ideas jointly with Fred and Chandra.
How soon does the virus take effect on this planet after the comet whisks by?
Well, I think they reckon it takes a few weeks to basically settle down through the atmosphere as in dust and so on.
Okay.
It's not immediate. I mean, it's not the next day. But it then comes down in these patches. One of the things they did was study the epidemiology of flu epidemics and other such diseases, and discovered that they were in a very spotty nature, and where you couldn't explain them by person-to-person contact. You know, why does somebody over in this county have the disease and somebody over in the next county has the disease, but they've never met? And they explain this by all these things raining down from the sky here and there in irregular patches, which goes against the person-to-person transmission theories. And they went into all this in great detail and showed that the conventional ideas of the spread of some diseases are wrong, but it can be explained by dust settling down from comet tails.
How did the ancients know this?
Well, how did they know about Sirius B?
Yeah.
You tell me, George. You know, you're just hiding
it
from us.
That's right. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello? Is he still there? You there?
Yeah. Yes, sir. I'm here. Good morning, George.
Okay, sir. Yes, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Robert and George. Yeah, this is Bob trucking across Ohio here. Robert made a comment just before the break about us being some type of an experiment. Somehow I believe this is true. I just can't get a good enough answer in life. I want to know why we're here and what we're doing on this planet. And I've listened to my answer off the air, and thank you very much. Keep up the good work, George.
Okay. Do you ever try to contemplate that, Robert? Why are we here?
Well, I think there's more than one answer to that question. It, of course, is the big one. We all wonder that. And I have views which don't all relate to extraterrestrial life by any means. For instance, I believe that there is a spiritual world as well as a physical world, and that after we die, we survive. And I also believe in reincarnation, that we have to keep coming back into physical matter in order to test ourselves, and that this is our process of growth. So I believe that as what you could call souls or spirits, we are eternal, and that we are struggling to improve. But by improve, I don't mean just get smarter. I mean get better people. That the really important thing is to become good and to become capable of love. And if you become intelligent as well, well, that's a bonus. So this, I think, is the basic thing that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with life on other planets visiting each other, although that's very important as well. When you come down to advanced civilizations which have managed to survive and not destroy themselves, I would think that they must be relatively spiritual type of civilizations, because otherwise they would tear themselves apart and they'd never make it to another planet, would they, as visitors?
Mm-hmm.
Because they would destroy themselves before they could get that far. So we have to assume that the majority of extraterrestrials who manage to engage in interstellar travel and have survived long enough to develop the technology to do that, to not destroy their planets with climate change, to not kill each other with incessant warfare, must be probably better people than we are. And that, therefore, we might be the beneficiaries of cosmic charity, we might have had a bit of tinkering with us in the past to try to give us a bit of a boost, you know, help these hopeless creatures evolve a little quicker, and maybe we've been given the gifts of civilization at some early stage, of high civilization, I mean, in order to hasten our evolution. And if so, is this a successful experiment? Would you, looking around us today, think that we have justified the faith reposed in us by anyone who might have tried to help us in the distant past? That's a question we should all be asking ourselves.
That's right.
And can we still pull ourselves together before it's too late?
Are you a believer in the multiverse, more than one universe?
Well, not in the many universes theory sense. And by the way, I was the first person to publish a popular article on that subject back in 1979.
Ah, right.
But I believe in other dimensions of reality. And I believe that the spiritual dimension is coexistent with the physical dimension, and that we're sort of, if you look at it like this, if you slow up or speed up film, you see images of slow motion and ultra-fast motion. You know those shots where from the top of the building you see the lights of the cars making streaks.
Right.
In the road, or you see these fast sequences where you can see the sunrise and the clouds moving and all of that. Imagine multiplying that many times and in a more profound manner, that we're kind of moving at different speeds, and it's, you can't really see people who are in the spiritual dimension, although maybe they can see us. I believe in all that kind of thing, and that there's a great deal of interest taken in us by people in the spiritual dimension, just as I believe there is also by other people in the physical dimension who happen to be from other worlds, and that the whole of reality is far more complex than we in our daily lives imagine.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Patricia, and I'd like to ask your guest, George, he stated his view on abortion, and personally I'm not for abortion either, but what is his view on capital punishment and war? If he
okay, I tell you what, I appreciate your question, but I want to devote this hour to questions about either the Dogon tribe or, as we're talking about, the oracles of the dead. I don't want to get into those socio discussions right now. Thanks anyway. Next up, our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's Cara calling from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi.
It's a very interesting show, interesting guest. What I would like to ask is, the ancient Egyptians, one of the oldest recorded civilizations on the planet, had no word for belief or religion, and had no belief or religion, basically. Where did these concepts come from, and how did they become such an integral part of the human condition? And second, and I apologize for this, but secondly, what does the gentleman contribute to the degradation of a moral society? And I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
I guess you can have those, Robert.
Well, of course, what I said about the ancient Egyptians is one of the most interesting questions in the whole history of world religions, because it's such a shocking thing to realize, isn't it, as our friend from Toledo, Ohio, has just pointed out. Where did belief come in and become so strong with us? Where did religion as a sort of institutionalized belief system get going? It's partly the natural tendency of all establishments to become solidified and concretized and bureaucratized. But also, what really happened in the Western world, and everything in China and India is completely different, so we'll leave them to one side for this discussion, is that the peoples of the book came into it all, by which I mean Jews, Christians, and Muslims. When you think, if you step back and imagine that you're not a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim, and you're just sort of looking from outer space or something, and there are these people called Jews, Christians, and Muslims running around on planet Earth, and who are they, and what is it they believe and think? The first thing that would strike you about them is that a devout one, as opposed to somebody who merely pays lip service to it, believes that there is one central book. That's why they call the people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
One central book, which essentially contains all the answers to the mysteries of the universe. And as I sometimes joke, the Jews only have half a book because they only have the Old Testament and not the New. And so you could say that the Jewish religion is half a religion because it's based on half a book. That's a joke, and that's, you could call that Jewish humor, if you like. I do not mean to denigrate Jews by any means. I think they're cleverer than most people, and I'm part Jewish myself. And so I would say that the peoples of the book adopted a kind of fanatical approach whereby they thought all the answers were in whatever their book was. You can call it the Torah, or you can call it the Bible, or you can call it the Quran. And it's written by God. You can call God Allah, or God, or Yahweh, or whatever you like. You can change the terminology, but the thinking is the same. It's reductionist thinking. It says that if you've got that book, that's all you need. Now, of course, that's not completely true, because when you go into it, the Muslims have got the Hadith, which are the sayings of the Prophet. The Christians have got the fathers of the church.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews have got the Talmud, which is all the rabbis talking. So they don't really believe the one book, but they officially believe the one book theory. Now, when you've got everything reduced to that simplistic level where everything's in the one book, then you have what's called religion. And belief is explained by, do you believe what's in the book? Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
This is where I think it all went wrong. In other words, I don't mean to condemn all religions, but I, on the other hand, would not unreservedly praise all religions either. And what I'm saying about the one book theory of the universe is that it is ludicrous. And that's what happened. And that's where the words and concepts of religion and belief came in. If you turn to the Hindus, you find that Hinduism does not have belief, because there is no unity of doctrine in Hinduism. I know, because I even began doing a PhD in it, and I have a degree in Sanskrit, which is the language of Hinduism. And if you go to China, Confucianism is not even a religion at all. You could loosely call it a creed. And Taoism is not really a religion. It's a sort of philosophy. So religion and belief are really Jewish, Christian, Muslim concepts exclusively. And they come from this weird idea that you can reduce all the answers to all the mysteries of the universe to a book.
And I agree. You can't.
Good, George. Good. Let's hear more of it.
Next up, west of the Rockies. Hi there.
Hi, this is Deb from El Sobrante in California, the
Hi.
San Francisco Bay Area. And I was calling because your guest teased us about the musical aspect of our species. And I know that as a former musician in this life, that I would be very interested in hearing more about the idea that perhaps there is a purpose to our species after all.
Well, she's right. You did tease us a little bit, Robert. We ran out of time when you were talking about that.
Well, actually, I'm terribly glad she's raised this. Hello, Deb. I wasn't teasing, actually. I was perfectly serious. This is what I really, really believe, if I may use the word belief, imported from the people of the book. I'm serious about this. I really am. I believe that because we're a sort of weird, semi-psychotic species, that we have an ability to put excitement into music, which more serene species can't manage. I really believe that the most important thing that humanity has produced is its music. I'm a great music lover, and I'm engaged in musical projects. In fact, I have founded a mini label for classical music, which hasn't launched yet, but we're doing a lot of CDs at the moment. And I run a foundation which has sponsored a recital in London, and we're co-sponsoring that recital again at Carnegie Hall on June the 3rd in New York, if you want to come. It's called The Later Art of the Fugue. And one of the aspects of music that most concerns me is the music of Bach. And so I have commenced and am funding a project called The Later Fugue Project to discover what happened to the fugue after the death of Bach.
Huh. Stay with us. We'll be back with more.
Robert, at any time when you were tunneling your way through these passageways, did you get scared or did you think you were going to get stuck down there?
I did on several occasions think I was going to get stuck down there. I'm not the scared type, but I was apprehensive and concerned. I was particularly worried about the narrowest 18-inch high bits because, you see, if you pass out, which is easy to do from shortage of oxygen, in that nobody can save you because nobody can get to you without them passing out. And so we adopted a safety procedure of going along, of taking a rope, whereby we could literally be, it was just tied around me so that I could be pulled out if I passed out. But it would be kind of rough, you know, that would not be pleasant. And there's all the dust in your face, too, you know, it's terrible.
About a year ago, I had an MRI, and they wheeled me in to this tunnel device, and I had to get out of there. I mean, I went nuts. There's no way. And here's a guy who had I've never been claustrophobic in my life, but after that experience, I'm not sure I could go through this tunnel.
George, were they looking for your genius?
If they were, they probably needed a microscope.
Your modesty is overwhelming.
back to the phones. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Ted here in the Bay Area, California.
Yeah.
And I'll try to put this as succinctly as possible. Question and comment about the Dogon for Robert. I am a first-year graduate student just starting my PhD in astronomy at a University of California campus that will remain nameless in case one of my professors happens to be listening. Well, hey, you know, we spend a lot of time late at night in front of telescopes, and you are listened to quite often. Coast to Coast is a big favorite. Anyway, here's the deal. I absolutely love the show. I've been listening since early when Art started, and I think, George, you have assumed his mantle with dignity and poise. However, I've got to say that when topics of astronomy are brought up, there's seldom, if ever, a dissenting viewpoint from the more traditional conservative sciences, and I'd like to offer that here. As to the Dogon, certainly there are really fascinating coincidences and mysteries there that they would know things such as that Saturn has rings, that Jupiter has four large moons. However, I'd like to just respectfully suggest that, though not just a complete coincidence, the knowledge that they display is equal to the knowledge that traditional Western science had about our own solar system in the late 1800s. And that, for instance, that we had discovered that the Galilean satellites, Io, Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede, the large moons of Jupiter existed, and that you could see the rings of Saturn through a fairly primitive telescope, and that pretty much having to do with various European expeditions to Mali to observe the transit of Venus, that there was cultural contamination, that they kind of met the Dogon and said, oh, yeah, you know, we're looking at the stars, and, oh, there's Saturn, and Saturn has rings, and that's Jupiter, and Jupiter has four moons. In other words, it's selective evidence to say that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, if I could just briefly
finish up.
If I could just really quickly finish, because we know now that all four of the Jovian planets have rings. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune have rings. Jupiter has many more than four moons. It has like 63 at the current count. They find more every month. Right. It doesn't even warrant a press release. So I just wanted to say that it seems that another more prosaic explanation could be that the Dogon had just heard about this through explorers coming by. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, no, don't hang up. Don't hang up. You're still there?
Okay. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because then I want Robert to chime in. But that, and I would agree with you that that is very possible. But how does that explain their description of these aquatic beings and everything else?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Explorers aren't going to bring them that story.
Well, I mean, it's neat, but it's a story. I could make up. We're creatures of pattern recognition, and if we see a pattern and we can't come up with an immediate answer for it, we'll invent an explanation.
Okay, let's let Robert now jump in, and now you can listen on the radio for that. I just wanted you to hear that. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, George and Ted, and by the way, I love the Bay Area. You're lucky to live there. I can tell you more details, which will show that this suggestion that you've made, which has been made countless times and discussed by me on numerous occasions, as you can imagine, doesn't hold up. There's a lot more detail to the knowledge that the Dogon have than I was able to explain on this program. But in response to your question, I'll have to tell you that the Dogon know about superdense matter. They know that Sirius B is made of a material which they admit does not exist in our own solar system, and they know the difference between different solar systems and that they are separated by space. And they describe this. Now, superdense matter was not known in the 1800s. It only really was known since 1926 when Eddington postulated it. So if you're talking about the transmission of all this knowledge to the Dogon, you have a very narrow window because the French anthropologists started studying the Dogon about 2 years later, as I recall. And they certainly didn't know about superdense matter. So I was simplifying, for the purposes of a radio discussion, the fantastically complex information possessed by the Dogon. And I didn't go into superdense matter because that's a bit esoteric. But if you're talking about the timing and possible transmission by Europeans to the Dogon of all this astronomy, that won't work. Now, I've examined this from many other angles. The only Europeans who were really based in Mali in those days were a missionary group, a Catholic missionary group called the White Fathers, Les Pères Blancs, because they're French. And so I wrote to the head of the mission of the White Fathers in Mali, and I said, were they in touch with the Dogon? And he wrote back, and he said, no, not before 1949 or whatever it might have been. And I have gone into this at great length, and I'm afraid that it would have been a great simple answer for some of the mystery to claim that it was all transmitted by visiting Europeans, but I'm afraid that's not possible. In addition, there is a lot of physical evidence of Dogon as statues and carvings and whatever that got hundreds of years old, referring to all of this long before the earliest missionary ever set foot in anywhere below the Sahara. So one can go on in this vein, and I won't take up any more time giving any more details. But discussed this at great length, and I've also published something you won't have seen. It was a pamphlet brought out by my British publisher when the 1998 edition of The Sirius Mystery came out, called The Sirius Mystery Answering the Critics, in which I reply to lots of articles by people like Carl Sagan and so on, disposing of all their points of complaint very meticulously. And I'm just about to put this onto my website as a PDF download.
Great.
I would recommend that you get that. I'll put it on in the next week or so. That's www.robert-temple.com, and I'll put it on there as a download, which I highly recommend to anyone who really wants to go into this, because it's additional information which is not available in the book.
And there's no way any missionaries would have talked about Sirius C, which is the red dwarf.
That's right. Well, Sirius C was suspected for some time, but not proved. So it was under discussion by astronomers, but it was only confirmed and confirmed to be a red dwarf in 1995, 20 years after I predicted that this would happen. So that, according to the way science works, is what's known as the verification of a prediction, which is meant to verify the hypothesis. And none of the people who in the late 70s were writing nasty articles about me and calling me an idiot for suggesting that there was a third star in the Sirius system have ever written to apologize and say, sorry, you were right, we were wrong, because, of course, people don't act like that. But it would have been nice if even one of them had said, gosh, hey, you were right after all.
Yeah, they don't do that, do they? No, that never happens. First-time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with us, with Robert Temple. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's Chloe calling from San Jose, California.
Hi, Chloe.
Hi. It's a great show tonight. I have two questions for your guests that are related. Hi, Robert.
Sure. Hi there. I like the Bay Area, as I said, and San Jose is getting pretty near the Bay.
Yeah, it sure is. I was curious whether the Dogon revealed how many planets there are in the Siren solar system and which planet the Sirens originated from. And there is a second question. I could go ahead and ask that and, you know, hear
it. Let's go one at a time.
Okay.
One at a time. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. They give very detailed information about the Sirius system.
Uh-huh.
They claim that there are not only three stars there, but several planets. And that the inhabited planet, which they call Emeya in Dogon language, orbits Sirius C, the
uh-huh.
third star. They're very specific. And they draw diagrams. I publish diagrams in the book showing how the planet goes around the star and the star goes around the other star. And it's all this very complex astrophysical information. And they're most emphatic about these details. And they talk about the orbital period of the planet and so on.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I will be ordering your book tonight. my second question regarding the dolphins that are in our oceans today. The bottlenose dolphins are a little larger than we are, sometimes growing to the length of around 12 feet. And they have a larger, more convoluted brain mass in proportion to body mass, indicating a larger brain than we probably have. And they are definitely more intelligent in their world than we are in ours, at the rate we're destroying this planet. And I was wondering if whether you were being facetious when you said dolphins were pets to sirens comparable to dogs on this planet. Because, you know, the cetaceans have been around for 60 million years. And could they not have taken to our seas and taken a completely different evolutionary path, you know, to become the incredibly beautiful mammals they are today?
Well, I think there's a lot of merit in what you say, and you might say that I was being semi-facetious, because I believe that the Namos, as the Dogon call them, probably exist, and that they are far more advanced than the cetaceans that we see here. But I don't mean to run down cetaceans. I'm a great admirer of them, and I think that we should take seriously, as people like yourself do, and especially people in California do, and places like that, where you might actually see a dolphin, whereas growing up in Kentucky, I never saw anything like that, because it's too landlocked.
Ah, but you saw racehorses. I'm sure you did.
There you go. There you go. Kentucky, the state of fast women and pretty horses. But to return to cetaceans, I think we need to take seriously the fact that they have a society of their own which we could justifiably call a cetacean civilization. And the fact that they don't waste time building skyscrapers and earning money might be good. And that therefore we should not really judge them by our standards and say, well, they can't take a hammer and a nail and build a house. Why would they want to? We need to accept them on their own terms, as our friend in San Jose obviously does. And I think that she has a completely valid point when she implies that the cetaceans have a civilization of their own, and that who are we to refer to them merely as pets? When I said that, I was being semi-facetious in the sense that I believe that they would be petas compared to the Namos, but I don't mean that they're necessarily inferior to us. So I'm sort of not like prejudiced against cetaceans, quite the opposite.
Robert, astronomers to date have found about 120 planets in other systems. I don't know if that includes the Sirius system. I don't think it does, but I've got to tell you, when technology, and it will, proves that there are planets in that system, it's going to make this theory just go right through the roof.
Well, we might be able to prove something without having to do that, because I referred at the beginning of our program to the possibility that the Namos might never have left our solar system, and they might have gone back into suspended animation, and that they might now be in a reanimated phase where they're monitoring our activities, in which case they must be very depressed. But what would be next?
Maybe not entirely. There's still some humans that I think they'd be impressed with.
I'm referring more to the state of the planet and the collapse of the atmosphere and those ecological problems.
Okay.
I don't
okay.
mean necessarily about us. I mean it would be obvious to them that we're approaching irreversible collapse of our ecosystems. This is really serious. If the atmosphere gets to the tipping point where it's irreversibly damaged and would require minimum 100,000 years to regenerate, then we haven't got much of a future left, except insofar as we might be able to either create intelligent robots to survive us who wouldn't mind the bad weather, or create space colonies or people who might be able to survive living in bubbles on the moon or in spaceships. And this, it may be that this happens all over the galaxy all the time, and that we have these roaming nomads who are sort of seeds spewed out by the dying flowers of their worlds, who are itinerant vagabonds looking for somewhere to set down before they move on. It may be that our history has been marked by the visit of just such beings, or they may have decided they can't get any further and they've gone back to sleep and they've got to stay here, or they may have destroyed themselves. They may have been marooned here. I mean, we don't know the answers to these things, but we should be thinking about them.
How do you get the books, The Sirius Mystery and The Oracles of the Dead?
Well, they're published by Inner Traditions, and you can buy them at friendly bookshops, but you can order them on Amazon.com, and I would recommend that. You can also get my book, The Genius of China. If you go to the Canadian Amazon or the British Amazon, that's Amazon.ca or Amazon.co.uk, you can get The Crystal Sun, which is a book of mine that we haven't mentioned, which is actually my longest and perhaps in many ways my weirdest book. And then you can get the book that my wife and I jointly did, published by Penguin, called Aesop, The Complete Fables. It's a Penguin classic. And some of my books are out of print or were never published in America, like my big book on world hypnosis research called Open to Suggestion, which was never published in the USA, and my translation of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which unfortunately is not available, but which was staged at the National Theater in 1993.
What a great story that would be. Robert, we're out of time, but like I said, you've got an open invitation to join us anytime you want. Okay, my friend?
Well, that's great. Thanks a lot, George. I really enjoyed appearing on your program.
Me too. Went by fast, didn't it, Robert?
It sure did. We could do it all again, couldn't we?
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.